God's trustworthy word. We're on day five, but we're on part four as far as the way that I laid my lesson plan out and the things that I have managed to accomplish in terms of going through the material that I had. We've been largely media-driven in terms of the kinds of things we've been talking about. We've talked about religion in the marketplace. We've talked about the impact that has on spirituality in general, on the Christian faith in particular, the overall perspective that exists, that it's kind of a level playing field and just pick and choose among the alternatives. We've talked about the secularization of America. We'll have a little bit more about that as we go along and thinking about some of the other ideas that are going to come to bear. We need to be, as Romans 13:11 reminds us, people who understand the times that we live in. Do this understanding the present time. The hour has come for you to wake up from your slumber, because your salvation is nearer now than when you first believed. We need to understand the times in order to hold on to our own faith, and more than that, in order to be able to make a defense of the Christian faith to others, whatever kinds of questions may arise. The Bible says in 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 5, first of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. And then verse 5 says, they deliberately forget. Do you realize that there are people who deliberately distort, who purposefully misunderstand, who are really not very interested in the facts when all is said and done because they have their own agenda? We talked about that a little bit the other day in terms of people who are malicious liars, people who purposefully distort the truth. We're going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow as well. But there are certainly scoffers in our time, people who say that everything continues as it has been from the beginning, people who are willing to deliberately overlook information, overlook facts. In the News Telegraph, a British newspaper, we have an article entitled Animals into the Ark 2x2, not if you believe the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. The biblical story of Noah's Ark is a great myth, devoid of any scientific or historical credibility, according to a new BBC program about the Great Flood. This is in keeping with the kinds of media reports that we have been looking at in the past week, simply dismissing the historicity, the reliability of the biblical account. Noah's Ark, which has been produced by the corporation's Religion and Ethics Division, argues that there is no evidence to support the idea of an ark, a global flood, or even a man called Noah. It claims that the story in the book of Genesis was a fabrication inspired by the story of King Gilgamesh, who was caught up in a flood while trying to transport his own livestock. I could talk for quite a little while about Gilgamesh and the story that we have of Gilgamesh in the epic. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. We'll visit a little bit of it and talk a little bit about it. But this is quite an interesting interpretation to me of the story of Gilgamesh, that it's the story of a king. Yes, people, scholars, think now that Gilgamesh was a real character, a real historical character. But the story of Gilgamesh is a highly mythologized account. The Epic of Gilgamesh, which runs through about a dozen tablets in the ancient Sumerian script, the story of Gilgamesh is certainly highly mythologized, and it would be difficult to sort out truth from fancy, but the scholars think that they're able to sort out a bit of truth about Gilgamesh and conclude that there really was a King Gilgamesh who really did reign. There's an interpretation in this particular BBC show that he was caught up in a flood while trying to transport his own livestock. That's very interesting, because in the Gilgamesh epic, it's not even Gilgamesh who goes through the flood. He meets the man who went through the flood and talks to him and gets an accounting of the flood from the man who experienced it. But in the Gilgamesh epic, he's not the man who goes through the flood. So even in terms of the Gilgamesh epic, there's some problems in the interpretation that's presented in this particular BBC program. I'm talking about that as though we all have some idea of the Gilgamesh epic. That's a story that was discovered in the 19th century in archaeological work. Tablets were discovered that had the story of a man who'd gone through a great flood, and people thought, wow, sounds like the flood of Noah. Well, it really doesn't sound very much like the flood of Noah, but it sounds a little bit like the flood of Noah. There certainly are some common elements in that part of the Gilgamesh epic and the story of Noah. And in the scholarly mood of the time in the 19th century, there were those who began to say, wow, we have finally found a source for a biblical story. This Gilgamesh epic is a source for the biblical story of Noah. If that's the case, it's a very bizarre kind of rendering, and I don't know of any historical equivalent anywhere of taking the kind of story that Gilgamesh is and distilling that down to the kind of story that Genesis has about Noah. There just isn't anything like that in ancient literature that I'm aware of anywhere else, any kind of distilling like that that takes place. Nevertheless, the story of King Gilgamesh not only has survived through the millennia, but actually we have a lot of copies now of various aspects, various tellings of the story of Gilgamesh. A lot of tablets have been found in the excavations in Mesopotamia, Iraq, in the Middle East. This story has been very well corroborated by archaeological evidence as a story that was widely known in that region, although not quite like the BBC presented it. Jeremy Bowen, the program's presenter, tells viewers it's time to forget the original story and start again. Well, you got it from the BBC, that must make it authentic. It's time to just forget the original story and start over. Here, several thousand years after the fact, we can effectively rewrite the account and tell people what really happened in the story of Noah. The traditional notion of the Noah story does not pass any sort of rational or historical test. Maybe it was not meant to, maybe it was made up. In the program, Bowen interviews a number of scientists and historians who dismiss the idea that the world was engulfed by a global flood. They say there's not enough water in all of the world's oceans to support a torrent of such proportions. Bowen further concludes that even 40 days and nights of continuous rain would not have produced enough water. So there you go. The experts say it couldn't have happened, and that's enough of that. They say there isn't enough water in the world. Is there enough water to flood the entire earth? Absolutely, there's enough water to flood the entire earth, but not as the earth is configured right now, with mountains that stand 28,000 feet high in the Himalayas, for example. If the earth were a smooth ball, the oceans would cover all the land to a depth of more than a mile. Has the earth always had the topography that it has now? Well, 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 6, revisiting what Peter said there and reading a bit more of it, he reminds us, first of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming he promised? Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on as it has since the beginning of creation, but they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also, the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. Peter says the world that came out of the flood was different than the world that went into the flood. Now, what all does that involve and what all does that mean? Well, we can speculate, and in fact, very competent engineers and scientists and thinkers have speculated about the kinds of changes that may have taken place during the process of the flood. And among them, there may have been tremendous movements of the continents. There may have been even bombardment from outer space, for all we know. We'll talk about that a little bit more shortly, and not in any great detail because it is speculative. But there were processes at work in the story of the flood that are mind-boggling. Before I read the passage that's up in front of you right now from Psalm 104, you know, years ago when excavation was taking place in Ur, the excavator, and Ur is one of those interesting places that the skeptics had said in the 19th century obviously didn't exist. It was one of those things made up by the biblical writers until they found Ur of the Chaldees and concluded that, okay, that they were wrong about that, but nevertheless, Abraham wasn't real and couldn't possibly, and so on, and so the story goes. But excavating in Ur, the excavator, the archaeologist came across a layer of clean sandy sediment, of water-laid clay. And above it there were ruins, and below it there were ruins. And there was a newspaper headline published in Europe, in Britain in particular, that said they had found evidence of the flood. They had found this deposit of clean soil there in Ur. And that particular claim made it into Halley's Bible Handbook, which really popularized it, because a lot of people who had a conservative view of Scripture have used Halley's Bible Handbook over the years. And that's one of the archaeological evidences that's in Halley's Bible Handbook. Unfortunately, it's totally wrong. It's not wrong that he found that layer. He certainly did find that layer, but that layer has nothing to do with Noah's flood. It just has to do with a flood. Yes, there was a flood, and yes, it left a deposit, but it was simply a local flood. It had nothing to do with the flood of Noah, although it has been widely reported, and is, you'll still hear it, it referred to sometimes today, because it is in Haley's Bible Handbook and probably in some other reference work that are still in use. But that has nothing to do with the story of Noah's flood. The catastrophe of Noah's flood was on a scale that is very difficult to even begin to appreciate. The changes that would have been wrought in this world by Noah's flood are considerably beyond the pale of what happens when a river overflows and lays several feet of mud into a community. It's very difficult to, I said that about three times now, but it is very difficult, make it four, to really comprehend the forces that were at work in the process of this flood that God unleashed upon the world to destroy the world, to inundate, not merely to inundate, but to remove human civilization and all life on earth that breathed air, except for that was secure in the ark. Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9, the psalmist says that God set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. The earth is very stable. And yet, there have been disasters that befell the earth. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains, but at your rebuke the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth. Now that psalm, it's poetic, and it doesn't give us any real indication of the kind of forces that were at work in the days of the flood and the days following the flood. But it does at least suggest that there were great geological changes that took place in the process of the flood and in its aftermath. When God rebuked the waters and they took to flight, this is talking about a very rapid removal of the waters from the earth. Genesis refers to a wind that God sent over the earth at that time. What all did that involve? I really don't know. But again, the idea here that David expresses to us, or that the psalm expresses to us, is that the waters were retreating at a rapid pace over the mountains and down into the valleys, which suggests that there was some upheaval going on and there was some dropping down going on. There was a real changing of the geology of the earth, of the topography of the earth, that was taking place at that time as mountains rose up, as valleys settled down. And all of that has to do with some of the processes that were in play during the flood, which we'll mention again shortly. Going back to the article about Noah's flood on the BBC, Jeremy Bowen, the program's presenter, tells viewers it's time to forget the original story and start again. Okay, we read that, but down the last sentence of that particular portion of the article, Bowen further concludes that even 40 days and nights of continuous rain would not have produced enough water. Well, that may well be the case if we're talking about a New Mexico thunderstorm, which can get pretty aggressive and pretty spectacular sometimes, but that's not what we're talking about. That's not the kind of process that was going on in that day at that time. In Genesis 7, 11, and 12, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Rain is, in a sense, the least of what was going on there. All the great fountains, all the springs of the great deep burst forth. What's going on there? Are we talking about seismic activity? Are we talking about volcanoes? Are we talking about geysers? Well, probably all of those things are going on at this point in time when the fountains of the great deep burst forth. And when the windows of heaven are opened, is that merely that rain started falling, perhaps for the first time in the history of the earth? You know, back in Genesis 2, it talks about how there was no rain at that time and how the ground was watered by a mist or by streams that flowed over the ground. Is this a change that had never occurred before, that all the water that's in the upper atmosphere comes down suddenly in an onslaught in a form that had never been seen before? I don't know for sure that it hadn't rained before, because Genesis isn't actually explicit about that, that it had not rained between the time of the garden and the time of Noah, but that's at least a possibility. It also occurs to me as a possibility, and you can take it or leave it, I don't really care one way or the other whether you do or don't, that when it talks about the windows of heaven being opened, indeed, that may involve comets or other kinds of bombardment from the skies above during this episode. My point is, this was more than a traumatic event. This is what is truly described as a catastrophic event that changed the world as it then was. The world that then was perished. That world died in the forces that God unleashed at that time. And God had every intention that there would be no particular sign of that violence-filled world that man had developed over the years since the creation had occurred. He had every intention of wiping man from the face of the earth, and that's exactly what he did with the processes that he unleashed at that time. But while Mr. Bowen said that 40 days of rain wouldn't be enough to inundate the earth, he really doesn't picture the kind of events that God is talking about here. And it wasn't merely rain, it was also the bursting forth of the waters beneath the surface of the earth. Tremendous seismic forces had to be involved in that, creating cavities in the ground below that later on were going to collapse into some of the valleys and trenches that the oceans occupy today. Great changes had to be taking place in the climate, the topography, changes in what would become the geology of the earth in future generations during those events of those days. Both the falling of the rain, the bursting forth of the fountains, whatever the windows of heaven involved, if it involved more than rain, and then the earth being inundated for about a year, being inundated with water, with all the forces that would be involved in that, the tidal forces that would be involved in that, as the earth continued to spin and the moon going around on its orbit and so forth. Well, going back to the News Telegraph article one more time, Bowen and his team also contradict traditional notions about the Ark itself, saying that such a huge ship, two-thirds the size of the Titanic, would not have been possible with the level of technology available at the time. Loading so many animals onto a single vessel would have taken 35 years, they claim. They conclude that the Noah story was invented by Jewish scribes who embellished the story of Gilgamesh to evoke an all-powerful and vengeful God. In their frame of reference, that would have happened maybe 400 or 500 years before Christ, somewhere in that time frame, to sort of solidify this idea of monotheism, and we talked a little bit about that last week. So the whole thing is dismissed, and we have the idea that the Noah story is an embellishment of the Gilgamesh epic. To embellish, I think John talked about embellishing something the other day. He was, I think, thinking of the first definition, not the second, when he was referring to himself embellishing something. To beautify by as, or as if by ornamentation, ornament, adorn, that's one kind of embellish, to make something look better. The other kind of embellish is number two, to enhance a statement or a narrative with fictitious additions, and that's the idea of the Noah story being an embellishment of the Gilgamesh epic, according to the critics. And this is not a brand new idea, it's just much more baldly stated now than it ever used to be stated, and in a much more public and open kind of forum than it ever used to be presented. But if there is an embellished story with fictitious additions, it must be the Gilgamesh epic that embellishes Noah, and not the other way around. In your experience, just what little experience you may have, as people recall a story or an event, does the story get simplified or more complex as time goes by? Does the story get neater and more believable, or does it become broader and less believable as it's passed from mouth to mouth and from person to person, and even in one person's lifetime as the years go by? It's my observation that big fish tend to get bigger as the years go by and the stories get told and retold. They don't generally tend to get smaller. And if you look at the Gilgamesh epic and the story of how this man, Utanap Ishtim, the man who went through the flood in the Gilgamesh story, how he was told that he should take his house and tear it down and build a boat out of his house, and then the boat that he built out of his house was going to be, I think it was 120 feet tall, 120 feet wide, and 120 feet long. I think it was a cubical structure. That must have been a really big house that he started out with, but that's not really the point. The thing is, if you read that story and how he loaded his entire town onto this boat along with the animals, and how the gods were unhappy because people were making so much noise and the noise was keeping them awake, and these kinds of aspects to the story, it's difficult for me to read the Gilgamesh epic and think that anybody read that and was inspired to come up with the Noah story. It just doesn't play for me. It's more than a stretch of the imagination. The Gilgamesh epic, the story of Utanap Ishtim, the faraway who went through the flood, it tastes to me a lot like the story of the labors of Hercules, where Hercules goes through rocks that smash together to destroy ships, and where he fights mythological monsters like the Minotaur, and where he diverts rivers to wash out stables and those kinds of things. And I don't think you could start with Hercules and end up with Samson, but I think you could start with Samson and end up with Hercules in terms of the way stories develop in the telling and retelling and the storytelling kind of tradition that occurs among human beings. And I don't think you could start with Gilgamesh or Utnapishtim and end up with Noah, but I do think you could start with Noah, and over a process of time, when the lifespans of people go from being 900 and some years to being 10,000 years, 20,000 years, which they are in some of these tales, that I think over a process of time, the story certainly could go the other way, and an embellishment of the Noah story through telling and retelling and political agendas and all those kinds of things coming into play, that it certainly could go the other way around, that the embellished Noah story could, over time, give you the kind of thing that you have in the story of Utnapishtim in the Epic of Gilgamesh. According to the BBC, did Noah really build an ark? This is an article by Jerry Bowen, the man who produced the TV program for the BBC. There are many problems with the story. A flood that engulfed the earth would have left a signature for geologists, yet none has been found. Okay? No flood signature that geologists can find. A flood did engulf the earth. This is me, not Mr. Bowen. A flood did engulf the earth and did leave a signature for geologists, a veritable John Hancock. I don't know if that's sufficiently a part of the national cliche anymore to rely on that. Why John Hancock? Because he signed his name big and bold on the Declaration of Independence, trying to set a good example for others, or maybe he was nearsighted, I'm not sure which, but he signed his name big and bold for all to read, and you don't have to get very close to it to see the John Hancock signature on there. It's very obvious. John Hancock is very obvious on that document. As far as physical evidence goes, there are numerous sedimentary deposits worldwide which suggest a universal flood. There are countless fossil deposits worldwide. And for fossilization to occur, organisms must be buried rapidly with sediment. You know, if you went to the dinosaur monument up there in Utah, they used to talk about slow accumulation of the fossils in that bone bed. Dinosaur bone beds used to be discussed in terms of gradual accumulation as animals died, and then their bones were washed down to a sandbar or something like that. And over a long, long period of time, they accumulated. But that doesn't work. It just plain doesn't work. Now, in dinosaur bone beds, they often are describing catastrophic events, at least catastrophic for the dinosaurs, where a bunch of dinosaurs were trying to cross a river at flood stage, and a bunch of dinosaurs got swept downstream all at the same time and drowned and then ended up being buried on a sandbar. But no longer the idea that one by one by one, over century after century after century, these things are accumulated, but rather that these bone beds tended to be formed all at once. Well, I have a story that covers that, okay? That they were accumulated all at once in a catastrophic way. And likewise, there were ideas about petrified forests, and these are things that I'm not going to spend a great deal of time or detail on, but up in Yellowstone, there's an upright, and it's not the only place, but there's an upright petrified forest, trees standing upright. And all the interesting theories that used to exist about how that petrified forest was formed, because trees have got to be buried in order for them to petrify. They've got to be covered over with mud, with silt, with some sort of water-carried debris. But here you had a forest that not only was upright, but actually it was in several layers, as though you had had one forest growing on top of another and then petrification occurring by stages, and just impossible to explain from a uniformitarian standpoint. But after the episode up there at Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake and all the trees that were blown into the lake, and the observation of what happens in that kind of a circumstance where you've had this catastrophic event, all these different kinds of trees are floating in the lake. And first one variety of tree gets waterlogged and kind of turns root down and sinks to the bottom, and then another kind of tree gets waterlogged and turns root down and sinks to the bottom. And so you end up with this layering of trees standing upright, being covered with silt and setting the stage. And how long does it take? Well, it takes a matter of a few years, of just decades, for this process to be completed, for this setting to occur. It doesn't take millions of years. It doesn't take long periods of forest regrowth. In fact, that never did make sense to describe the upright forest, the petrified forests of standing trees in those terms. But those kinds of things, and a lot of other things, are explainable in terms of a geology that includes a universal flood. And I live in a place that is very dry, and yet you can go out into the hills where I live, and you can find shells, petrified shells, you can find petrified shark's teeth, You can find petrified wood not too far from there. You can find these petrified worm casings where a worm has been closed up in the ground and the ground has turned a rock around it and left behind the traces of the worm that was once there. A flood that engulfed the earth would have left a signature for geologists. Well, I would suggest it did. It did. Do we know how to interpret all of these things? No. But these things are not even considered in terms of understanding the tremendous disaster of the Noahic flood, the flood of Noah, and all the damage that was done there, and all the things that were brought into being in terms of fossil relics and coal and oil and all those kinds of things in that one cataclysmic event. Did Noah really build an ark? The question on the BBC. And according to Jeremy Bowen, there are many problems with the story. If the story is taken literally, it would have taken 35 years for Noah and his family to load two of every animal on earth. 35 years. How long did it take? According to Genesis 6:20, Noah had a week. God had told him what was going to happen, and then in the final week, God said, okay, I'm going to bring the animals now, and you get them all settled on the ark, but I'll bring the animals to you. And Noah had 7 days to load the animals. He already had taken care of the provisioning. He already had the ark all ready to go, but 7 days to load the animals. God brought the animals to Noah, and they were loaded within 7 days, according to Genesis 6:20 through 7:10. Now, one of the things that needs to be mentioned here in terms of the whole concept of Noah's Ark, there have been a number of efforts to rationally explain from a naturalistic, scientific perspective how the Noah's Ark story could be sort of true, like a flood, a local flood in Ur, or like a catastrophic flood in the Black Sea. There was a TV program about 2 years ago of this fellow, the same guy who found the Titanic, went looking for Noah's flood, and he was looking for ruins around the shallow parts of the Black Sea, thinking that there may have been a catastrophic event that caused water from the Mediterranean to raise the level of the Black Sea and destroy a civilization around the edge of the Black Sea, and that would be the explanation of this flood that we have recorded in the Bible. There have been a lot of efforts to give a naturalistic explanation for Noah's flood. But the fact is, biblically, we are dealing with a series of miracles. Okay, there's no getting around that. If miracles are possible, then Noah's flood makes sense. If God can do miracles, Noah's flood makes sense. If God can't do miracles, though, not only do you need to throw out Noah's flood, we need to throw in the towel on this whole deal and go find something else to do. If God can do miracles, Jesus is raised from the dead. If he can't do miracles, then we're wasting our time. And so either it's credible on the basis of God having the power to do it, or it's not, when it comes to things like God bringing the animals to Noah. God didn't tell Noah, go out and catch all these animals. He said, they'll come to you. And God brought the animals that he wanted on the ark. Noah didn't have to figure out which ones. What was going to make the good breeding stock? Who was going to have the good DNA for future generations? And what is a kind anyway, which we'll come back to. Noah didn't have to figure those things out. God brought the animals he wanted on the ark to Noah, and Noah proceeded with the loading. Why would it take 35 years? If Noah is presented as doing this in 7 days, why would the BBC, why would Mr. Bowen say that it would take 35 years to load the ark? Well, here's another statement, another paragraph from Mr. Bowen. Even if such a feat of marine engineering had been possible, building the ark, there are about 30 million species of animals in the world. For so many creatures, a fleet of enormous arks would have been needed. 30 million species of animals in the world. Does that sound about right to you? Well, you know, I shared that number with David Campbell the other day, and David said, well, I'm not a taxonomist, but, never mind. I was teasing David a little bit about defining himself by what he's not, because he said something in another class about not being a, what was the word he used? It doesn't matter. Well, what is he? Yes, he is. He's a geneticist. He works with genetics on the molecular level. He's very competent in his field. He is very competent in his field. He doesn't pretend to know things that he doesn't know, which is a good trait, one that I could aspire to. Before discussing, this is from a biology page. It's a serious biology page. It's not a creationist page. It's not anything like that. It's an educational biology page, rediscovering biology. And this quote is straight from that page. Before discussing, I say page, I'm talking about on the web, all right, on the internet. Before discussing how scientists address the question, how many species of animals are on the planet Earth, let's first ask how many species of animals have been described. There's uncertainty even to the second question's answer. Some uncertainty reflects differences in opinion among taxonomists about whether different populations are indeed separate species. Those finches that Darwin was so fascinated in the Galapagos, are we looking at different species there on those different islands? Actually, we're probably not, because they're interbreeding and hybridizing, and they're not really different species. So some uncertainty reflects differences in opinion among taxonomists about whether different populations are indeed separate species. Some is due to inadequate centralized databases. While there are efforts underway to provide a centralized catalog of described species, none exist as of 2003. The most current estimates are that there are about 1.4 to 1.6 million described species of animals. That's a whole lot different than 30 million. A lot different. 1.4 million to 1.6 million described species of animals. This is considerably different than the number they used on the BBC. So where did the BBC come up with 30 million species for Noah to load on the ark? And notice the 1.4 to 1.6 million, we are not talking about air-breathing animals. We're talking about described species of animals. In fact, we're talking about, well, let's see what we're talking about. What are these 1.6 or so million species of animals? At least 1 million are insects. Equipped from JBS Haldane, polymath and one of the founders of the evolutionary synthesis, illustrates the taxonomic concentration of biodiversity. When asked about what he could divine from nature about the creator, Haldane replied that he must have had an inordinate fondness for beetles. Haldane's quip was in reference to the sheer quantity of beetle diversity. There are roughly 450,000 different described species of beetles, representing about 30 to 40% of the known species of insects. So when we talk about 1.6 million species of animals, 450,000 of those species are beetles. But some of them are really big beetles. There are about 200,000 described species of flies. Well, some of those are kind of, sort of big, too. In contrast, there are only about 9,000 species of birds and 4,000 species of mammals. Every year, about 2,400 new species of beetles and 1,200 species of flies are described. Thus, the number of species of beetles that scientists will describe in the next 5 years alone is greater than the total number of current bird species. Okay, so we know of about 1.6 million species of animals. About a third of those are beetles. Another huge chunk of those are flies, and in fact, the vast majority of those are insects of one kind or another. You see a real big shipping problem for Noah on that? Where did the BBC come up with 30 million species for Noah to load on the ark? I don't know. They must have included mold. They must have included bacteria. I don't know where they came up with 30 million species for Noah to load on the ark and to make that 35-year procession to get all those creatures on board Noah's Ark. Where did they come up with that? I don't know, but we've been saying you can't believe everything that you see on TV or read in the newspaper. These are folks that have an agenda of their own. They started out intending to prove that Noah's Ark was a joke, a historical fallacy, something that was made up. And when you start out with that kind of an agenda, sometimes you're not as careful about your facts as maybe you ought to be. But we also need to recall that facts, the fact that kinds do not equal species. When modern taxonomists from the 18th century onward talk about species, we can talk about species in terms of varieties of bears here in America, for example. But God in Genesis didn't talk about species. What did he talk about? He talked about kinds. Would Noah have needed a fleet of arks for several thousand species of birds and animals? God actually brought kinds of animals, not what biologists now call species. Those kinds would repopulate the earth, adapting to fill biological niches in the new ecology after the flood. They didn't deal with that question, of course, at all, that approach at all in the BBC program, where they talked about Noah needing to load 30 million species on the ark. Psalm 104, verse 30 says, "When you send your spirit, they are created." It's talking about animals in the world that we live in. It's talking about God's providential involvement in the created world that we are a part of. God has not abandoned his world. You know, there's an old argument from design that talks about finding a watch. If you find a watch laying on the beach and you pick up that watch and you look and you see the movement of the second hand and so on, and you look at the fine craftsmanship, would you conclude that that watch had just happened by accident? And no one would conclude that the watch had just happened by accident. There had to be a designer. There had to be a maker. When we look at the universe that we live in, the cosmos, when we look at biology, when we look at things on the molecular level, the same conclusion is inescapable. There had to be a designer. There had to be someone who made these things. The problem with the watch illustration, though, is that you can carry it too far, that the watch exists independently of its maker. And that is not true of the universe that we live in. God did not simply set up natural laws and then walk away to see what was going to happen. God is providentially involved in the universe that he created at every level. In terms of sustaining it by his word of power, he is involved in the universe that he has created. In terms of what happens on planet Earth, both among animal kind and humankind, God is involved. When you send your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. This is God's ongoing involvement, his providential involvement in the living creatures of planet Earth. In Job 39, when God is talking to Job, he reminds him of various things that are in his hands, things that he takes care of. Job 39, verses 5 and 6, "Who let the wild donkey go free? Who untied his ropes? I gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt, the salt flats as his habitat." Now, what's God saying he did with the wild donkey? You know, there's different kinds of donkeys. But the wild donkey, he says, "I especially fitted him for the niche that he fills in the wild ecosystem. I gave him the wasteland as his home, the salt flats as his habitat." He put him in a place where not many animals would have done well, but God put him there. But that wild donkey is clearly related to other horse kinds of animals. Did Noah need to take all the different horse kinds of animals on the ark, or did he only need to take a pair of those animals, and then God would take care of the diversification once those animals were off the ark and began to reproduce and fill the niches that would exist in this world? And obviously, I believe the latter. I believe that Noah took kinds of animals on the ark, that he didn't need to take representatives of, you know, big kitties and little kitties. He didn't need to take representatives of striped horses and plain horses. He didn't need to take all the different kinds of dogs and so on and so forth. He just needed to take representative kinds that God brought to him. And from those, God was capable of filling the niches that needed to be filled in the new ecosystem of the new world that Noah and his family would enter upon, would come out of the ark to see. Job chapter 39, verses 13 through 18, "The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully, but they cannot compare with the pinions and feathers of the stork. They don't fly. She lays her eggs on the ground and lets them warm in the sand, unmindful that a foot may crush them, that some wild animal may trample them. She treats her young harshly as if they were not hers. She cares not that her labor was in vain, for God did not endow her with wisdom or give her a share of good sense. Yet when she spreads her feathers to run, she laughs at horse and rider." What's God reminding Job of here? God's the designer, and he perpetuates these animals according to his will and his purpose, not only at the original creation, but in an ongoing way. God is involved in taking care of the planet Earth and all of its denizens that he created. Now, maybe I should actually back up to that before we get on to this next thought. In terms of thinking about God's involvement in this present world, one of the reasons that the whole dogma of evolution came about is because by the 18th century, those who were nominally Christian had come to a kind of mindset about the world that they lived in that was completely unworkable in terms of God's involvement there. It was a little bit of the idea of the watch that lays there on the shore, that everything has been done, that God has already created everything that would ever exist from the very beginning, that every kind of animal that ever was created by God, and so you could have no new kinds. I'm using the word kind in the rather careless modern vernacular rather than the biblical sense right now. You couldn't have any new varieties of animals because that would be in conflict with the idea of the created order. Nor could you have animals disappearing from the face of the earth because that would be in conflict with God's design plan as well. And they had no understanding of the idea of adaptation. It's not that the Bible was ignorant of the idea of adaptation, it's that the thinkers of the 18th century, religious thinkers, theologians, were ignorant of that idea. And that made for a rather vulnerable system. That made for a rather vulnerable idea of creation as we come into the 19th century, and the Lamarckian kind of division of the animal kinds and so forth. It made it an environment in which new thinking about the origins of species, or singular origin of species, was falling on very fertile soil, because there was a kind of a dead mentality about what God had done in the past. God was kind of boxed in terms of his ongoing involvement with his creation. The Bible never gave a picture like that, that God had made every sort of creature that would ever exist at the very beginning, had perpetuated them on the ark, and that there would never be any variation in species. That kind of thinking is not a part of the Bible, but it was a part of the 18th century analysis of the created world in which we live, and it set a very ripe environment for the kind of thinking that developed into Darwinian evolution. The BBC asserted that the ark was not big enough. We've already radically trimmed down the number of animals that needed to go into the ark. Even dealing with species, as far as animals are concerned, we're looking at several thousand, not 35 million. But we're not dealing with species in terms of what God was doing there. We're dealing with kinds. Nevertheless, the volume of the ark would be 450 feet long by 75 feet wide by 45 feet high. Is that right? Are those the right dimensions? 300 cubits by 30 cubits by 50 cubits, all right? This equals 1,518,750 cubic feet and is comparable to 569 modern railroad boxcars. And these numbers and this analysis are widely available. They were in the Genesis Flood 40 years ago, the book of that title, and they have been widely reproduced elsewhere. While there are some very large animals on Earth, the average size of all those animal species is actually smaller than a cat. But usually in doing these numbers, people settle on the size of a sheep as a good arbitrary size to settle on. Most of those species of animals we're talking about are actually down in the rodent category. We're talking about very small animals in terms of the vast majority of species on Earth. There are not that many really large animals on Earth. One boxcar can carry 240 sheep. Even if Noah took all of the known species, which are many more than kinds that Genesis talks about, on average, including the pairs and the sevens, 318 boxcars, or 56% of the ark's capacity, would easily carry all the animals. Noah didn't need a fleet of arks. He needed one ark with plenty of space. In fact, it's very likely, and this also is in that book, The Genesis Flood, that was written 40-something years ago, it's very likely that all the animals could have easily fit on the second story of the ark, that the provisions could have been on the third, the lower story of the ark, and that the people could have lived with lots and lots of space for themselves on the top floor of the ark without having to be constantly surrounded by animals. There are other aspects to this in thinking about the animals. Almost all animals have some kind of a state where they can enter into a torpor or hibernation, that kind of a state when they're in the dark, when it's cool, which is probably the prevailing conditions inside the ark, which didn't have a lot of windows, but only around the top, that the middle floor, the lower floor, would have been dark most of the time. And animals become, by and large, very manageable in those kinds of circumstances. They don't take a lot of care, they don't take a lot of food, they don't take a lot of water in those kinds of circumstances. Many of the species have that kind of a safety valve built into their behavior, and probably to the advantage of Noah and his family. I'm sure they had a lot of work to do on the ark. I'm sure the ark was real, if you haven't gotten that impression yet. I'm sure there really was an ark built by Noah and his family, and maybe with hired helpers too, for all I know. But I am sure that they had plenty to do on the ark, but I'm also sure that it was not an overwhelming burden, that God gave them a job that was within the limits of their abilities to perform. Did Noah really build an ark? Jeremy Bowen asked. The traditional shape of Noah's Ark comes from the imaginations of 19th century artists. It would have been about 450 feet long, and experts say it would have broken apart. Okay, how do you test that? How do you test that? Build a 450-foot wooden boat, 50 feet wide, 30 feet tall. How do you test that to see whether it would have broken apart or not? And using the kind of wood that Noah used, you know, it's described as acacia in the NIV or gopher in the Old King James Version. What kind of trees did Noah have to work with? What kind of trees did that primeval earth have on it that he could work with to make the timbers that this ark was going to be built out of? Well, one thing that can be noted about Noah's ark is, and this was mentioned in a lesson the other day, is the dimensions of it indicate proportions that are very, very seaworthy. That much is true. The 6-to-1 ratio of the length to the width of the ark make for a very seaworthy vessel. It's a ratio I have read. I haven't tried this out, haven't gone and asked the people who participate in this, but it's a ratio that's used by the rescue boats up at the mouth of the Columbia River, which is very, very rough water. But this is supposed to be a very stable ratio for water going craft, the 6-to-1 ratio of Noah's Ark. Only it's not 6-to-1, is it? Am I saying that right? Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure if I'm saying the right numbers, but I'm sure that what I'm saying is true, even if I'm saying the wrong numbers about the ratio. Okay. Sometimes your mind just won't function on normal usage when you're standing up like this. All right. It does? It gets worse? According to Chinese history, I found this just a fascinating tidbit that I had to share with you, and I only heard about it a couple of weeks ago, so this was new information to me, but I think it's relevant information. Admiral Zheng He, have you ever heard of Admiral Zheng He? Well, have you ever heard of Columbus? Magellan? Why have you heard of them and not him? Because what he did was probably just as significant as what they did. But he was Chinese, not Western, and we tend to hear about what happened in Western civilization, not what happened in Eastern civilization. Admiral Zheng He had a flagship. Actually, I think he had half a dozen of these, but he had one that he commanded in the early 15th century, which was 440 feet long. What do you suppose it was built out of? It was built out of wood, right? He had a flagship 440 feet long and nearly 200 feet wide, and it had 9 masts. Did Noah have 9 masts to contend with on his? What was his boat built for? Floating, that's all. It just had to float. That's all it had to do. Zheng He built this ship, and I looked at some of the mathematics that were involved in trying to figure out the engineering of what it would take to steer this thing, and it would have been a monster to try and steer. It would have taken a lot of men to get this ship anywhere, and yet they sailed this ship. He had a flotilla of thousands of vessels at his command. The fleet under the command of Admiral Zheng He at this time in the early 15th century was bigger than the combined fleets of every nation in Europe, but we don't know anything about him because he was Chinese. 70 years before Columbus sailed his 85-foot Santa Maria. Do you see the little impression of the Santa Maria there in front of the Chinese ship? And that's to scale. The boat that Columbus came to America on was 85 feet long, and that's to scale against this flagship of Admiral Zheng He, which is well documented. The place where it was built, it's all really very well documented that this ship actually existed, as well as his fleet and many of his other exploits. 70 years before Columbus sailed his 85-foot Santa Maria across the Atlantic, Zheng He sailed his ship with a crew of 1,000 all over the South Pacific. He sailed it to India. He sailed it to the islands. He sailed it all over the South Pacific. And some think that he sailed it all the way around Africa, and some think that he sailed it also not only around the Cape of Good Hope, but around Cape Horn, all the way around South America, and visited various places along the American coast. Now, that part is not nearly so provable as the fact that he definitely had this ship, and it was in use for years in the waters of the South Pacific. But some think he circumnavigated the globe and visited America long before Magellan or Columbus. You know, that whole thing about people coming to America, it just gets more convoluted all the time, and I love it. I love it that it does, because when people think, when scientists, when scholars think they've got everything nailed down, it usually ends up that they just don't have all the information after all. I was watching a program the other day, and I had to verify that there was some legitimacy to it about the Australians who came to America. The pre-Columbian, in fact, the pre-Asian Australians who came to America. Australians who came and established colonies in America before the Asians came across the Bering Strait, you know, to become the Indians of North America. And the North American Indians then moved into South America and displaced the Australians that were here ahead of them. And this seems pretty solid. It seems like it very, very likely is the case. And in terms of the kinds of numbers that are thrown around for these things, they were here a long, long time before the Asians made their immigration here. And they keep finding indications that, you know, others who came. And I appreciate all of those kinds of insights, because they do remind us that people don't always know what they're talking about when they nail things down in solid terms. This is how it was. This is the fact of the matter. Very often, there's a lot more information that we simply don't have And if we did have it, it would change the picture radically. But at any rate, the BBC said, the experts say the Ark would have certainly broken apart. I'd like those experts to analyze Zinghi's flagship and determine whether it was sailable or not, because it was a much less seaworthy craft with the dimensioning that it had. It was what they're calling a super junk. It was based on the design of a Chinese junk, only much larger than their traditional junk is concerned. But I'm sure that the experts would have looked at this vessel and said, that vessel's not seaworthy. There's no way that he's going to be able to do what he wants to do with this vessel. According to cultural traditions worldwide, every major culture has a flood legend. Of over 200 flood legends, 95% say the flood was universal. Does the Bible say the flood was universal? Is there any doubt about that the flood was over the whole earth as far as the Bible is concerned? 95% of flood legends say the flood was universal. 70% say that survival depended upon a boat. 66% say the wickedness of man was the cause. 88% say there was a favored family. 66% say the remnant was warned, and 67% say animals were also saved. 57% say the survivors ended up on a mountain. 35% say birds were sent out. 9% say 8 people were saved, and 7% mention a rainbow. There are flood legends all over the place, and all of them have some elements in common with the flood story of Noah. Why is there this prolific racial memory of a flood? Well, at least one possibility is that there really was a flood that left such a deep impact on human culture and human psyche that it was passed on and passed on and passed on, that occasion when humankind faced its virtual annihilation and had to start over. The Bible consistently teaches a worldwide catastrophic flood occurred in the days of Noah. Isaiah 54, verses 9 and 10. To me, God said, this is like the days of Noah, when I swore that the waters of Noah would never again cover the earth. So now I have sworn not to be angry with you, never to rebuke you again. Though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed. Have the mountains ever been shaken before and the hills removed? I suspect that those things have happened before. Though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love for you will not be shaken, nor my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord who has compassion on you. In the days of Isaiah, when God's talking to Isaiah in the 8th century BC, did they believe in Noah's flood? Yes, they believed in Noah's flood, and that it covered the earth, and it would never happen again, just as is recorded there in the 8th and 9th chapters of the book of Genesis. Matthew 24, verses 37 through 39, the words of Jesus as he's talking to his disciples about great travail that is to come upon the earth, culminating in his own second return. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. What did Jesus believe about Noah? Jesus believed that Noah was a real man. If Jesus was mistaken about that, if he was mistaken about the flood, then we're back at that place where, why bother with any of this stuff? If Jesus didn't know, because he claimed to know. He claimed to know what God had done. He claimed to know God's purpose and God's plan. He claimed to have been with the Father at the creation. He claimed to have seen Abraham and the things that Abraham was doing. If Jesus didn't know, then we don't have much to stand on as far as the Christian faith is concerned. Jesus considered Noah a real character and the events described there as real events, and he says the world's going to be in the same predicament when he comes back again. His own second coming is going to be much like that. People going on with their ordinary lives. I think it's interesting that in the book of Genesis, we're told that every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually, and the earth was filled with violence for man's sake. And yet Jesus' assessment of the general outlook of human beings at that time, what was it? Everything's just fine. Everything's just fine. It reminds me a lot of the kinds of times that we live in right now. Everything's just fine. Everything's continuing along okay. As long as we've got our economic prosperity, what's there to worry about? Hebrews 11 and 7, by faith Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith he condemned his city, his town, what? The world. By his faith he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. 1 Peter 3, 18b through 20, Jesus was put to death in the body, but made alive by the Spirit, through whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison who disobeyed long ago, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And what does Peter go on to talk about there? Baptism. In the same way, baptism now saves us. Not the washing away of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God. Baptism means something because it has something in common with the work that God did in the past of giving people a fresh start, of starting the world over again through the people that he had chosen. But the basis of the authority for baptism lies in the legitimacy of the flood story. 2 Peter 2 and 5, if God did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, again, it's the world that we're talking about here, isn't it? But protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others, eight people saved in that wooden box that Noah built. Well, when the Bible and pagan myths have similarities, there are three possibilities. And now I'm talking about the Gilgamesh epic and those 200 myths, those 200 flood stories that exist all through the world. There are three possibilities when the Bible and pagan myths have similarities. One possibility is that the stories have nothing whatsoever to do with each other. It just so happens that the story is here and the story is over there, and there's no connection between them at all. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the Bible story is adapted from the pagan myth and is thus false. And that's the presumption of much of modern scholarship as reflected in what really is a very shabby show that the BBC put together. When all said and done, they didn't line up their facts very well, even of what they should have lined up with their skepticism about Noah's Ark. But a possibility that is widely considered, especially since the 19th century among scholars, is that the Bible story is adapted from the pagan myth, and thus the Bible story is false. But if that's the case in the Noah story, then Isaiah has no credibility, Jesus has no credibility, Peter has no credibility, the Bible has no credibility. It's important to see how these things are all interconnected in terms of our defense of what we believe. The third possibility is that the pagan myth is a corrupted retelling of what really happened and is indirect support for the Bible. And not only my confidence in the Bible, but my observance of how human beings are lead me to believe that this is really the case. That when we have pagan myths that have elements in common with the biblical stories, in many cases, especially those myths that arise in that area of the world where the what was at one time really the center of the world in a very real way, and still seems to be in some political respects and economic respects, that stories spread out from there. God knew stories would spread out from there. God wanted his people to be there and testify of him in that land of Canaan, rather than having the Canaanites there and their stories going all through the world on those trade routes that radiated outward from there. But in fact, the mythology that spread out from there very often was a twisted and deformed kind of mythology. You know, when we read about the days of Abraham, it's evident that in the Canaan of his day, people still knew who God was. You could still have a Melchizedek, king of Salem, who was priest of God Most High, who knew who El was, El Elohim, who knew who God Most High was. And you come down the line several hundred years to the days of Rahab, and there still was a memory of that God. But he had been so distorted and so weakened in the minds of the people that he was no longer a significant figure in the pantheon of gods that they worshipped. He had been supplanted by more dramatic, embellished figures like Baal and Asherah and others that were part of that pantheon. The pagan myth, as far as my understanding, when the Bible and pagan myths have similarities, sometimes it's number one, that the stories have nothing actually in common, they just happen to sound similar. It's never number two. The Bible did not borrow from the mythologists, but it is often number three, that the pagan myth is a corrupted retelling of what really happened and is indirect support for the Bible. And I'll leave that with you while you take your break today.